Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
It's one thing to figure out what we want to change in the world. It's another thing entirely to build a movement of people who want to make that change together. But there are insights and lessons about how to do this and how not to do this from those working on the front lines of change. Today's Changemaker Chat is with Anand Gurdadas. Anand is the author of Persuaders, a brilliant new book where he has spoken to well-known and less well-known American changemakers to assemble insights not only about their journey into making change, but in particular about effective strategies for building a movement of people, what he calls the art of persuasion. Here we learn more about Anand's own journey to the book, about his career as a journalist and a writer, and how he has wrestled to understand the boundary lines in his own identity as an American of Indian heritage. We then explore a variety of insights about persuasion and movement building, from the communication techniques of the magnificent Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to the insights about difference and identity from Loretta Ross. He makes the case for the power of the bridge builder. He argues that those of us that have lived and experienced different places and communities, where we have the lived experience of different borderlands, that these experiences give us immense power in the ability to relate, to connect, and to persuade. The chat is a clarion call for the kind of receptive and thoughtful change-making that we need today, where every action is seen and understands the reactions that it causes, and where our goal must not only be to change big decision makers, but to make space for each other, and how we receive and live with the changes that we seek in the process of the changes that we make. So, let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers UK episodes are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the UCL Policy Lab. They both bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. We are broadcast on Acast as part of the Iconoclast Network, so you can find us there as well as on all the usual podcast apps. You can also find out more about Changemakers on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Anand, welcome to the Changemakers Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is my pleasure. So, look, we always ask our guests what kind of changemaker they are. I wonder if you've written a lot about changemaking in different forms. I'm wondering how you might answer that question. What kind of changemaker are you, Anand?
I mean, I think as a writer, I think of myself as an indirect one in a few different ways. I think, you know, I am not the person getting the law passed or, you know, organizing the phone bank for the election or building the movement across, you know, a country. I'm the person who tries to look at what's going on and capture it and distill it and contextualize it and maybe say the thing out loud that needs to be said, that lots of people are maybe thinking, that lots of people are experiencing, but maybe they themselves cannot say. And so, you know, this theme of change has been a big one in my life because I think I write about certainly the act of change making. I write about things that need to be changed. But I've also spent, you know, in some ways, a lot of my career and my four books so far writing about people dealing with change, not on the making end of change, but, you know, this is called the change makers, but there's also, you know, far more of us in a way are change receivers. And a lot of my career, whether as a foreign correspondent in India for the New York Times or more recently in the kind of era of growing populism and right-wing authoritarianism in the US, has been trying to understand how people make sense of eras of change and societies that are changing and how at some moments we are better and at other moments worse at helping people cope with change, walk through change. Mm. And I think that theme of change, therefore, is kind of, you know, animating for everything that I do and think about.
Yeah, I hear that in you. So, I mean, let's, in a moment, I want to talk to you about a bit more detail about that story, about how you have experienced and dealt with and processed change through your life. And I guess how that has brought you to this time where you're now writing about the process of change. But I also want to, I mean, we're going to spend a lot of the podcast talking about some of the reflections that you've had about change. I think that what you describe as the role of a writer, someone who's writing about the process of change, being able to step back. I know a lot of people who would listen to this podcast in part would do so they can step back from the day-to-day acting around change making and reflect on the process of change. And I think that is a really important part of change. It's where the new ideas come from, right? It's where the new breakthroughs in change making come from. So also want to pay credit to that role. You know, you might not be passing the act, but enabling people to think differently about how they do that kind of work might help them pass it better next time.
I certainly hope so. You know, I'm struck by something that I once heard Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, who I'm sure is known to many of your listeners in
she
Australia.
She is. We've heard about her down here. It's true.
I know it's far away, but some people travel, and I think she's one of them. You know, she once said something in a conversation with the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. I think they were speaking together on a Martin Luther King Day commemoration. And she said, you know, as someone who is at that point in government, she had newly in government, she said, it's actually writers and artists who help create the public will. And it's lawmakers who help enact the public will. Mm. But it's kind of difficult for lawmakers to create the demand and satisfy it. What people want, what they don't want, what they're afraid of, what they think they can have. You know, a senator or a congressman is not necessarily best positioned to do that. I was speaking to another person in Congress in the U.S. the other day, a U.S. senator who I think is one of the most thoughtful senators out there, Brian Schatz. And I said, you know, what is your larger sense of why there is a big authoritarian movement in the United States right now? Let's get out of the day-to-day fight. What is going on in millions and millions of people's hearts that they want fascism in America? Like, what's happening to people if we look at it empathetically and openly? And he said, to be honest, I don't have the luxury in my job of thinking about something that big. Oh. I don't have the luxury of thinking that far upstream. I'm just downstream trying to deal with each thing. And so, yeah, I think there is a place for writers and artists to help kind of create the will, the set of fears, the set of aspirations, the set of anxieties, the set of hopes that people have, which then people in politics kind of act on.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you know, if we were the podcast were about me, I'd get into a conversation about how what you've just described is very true in my life. But it's not about me. This conversation is about you. And so, you know, you raised it already, the idea that responding to a world of change, whether it's now in this creeping crisis, political crisis in the United States that we also are all watching, by the way, we're watching this year in particular with bated breath and a level of fear and trepidation. But how did you, tell us the long story about how you came to be writing about social change, and feel free, like you are a writer, so I have no doubt you are capable of telling us a few powerful vignettes about how you have come to be interested in these questions. Feel free to go all the way back, as far back as you feel as relevant, to tell us about why you came to this point.
Yeah, I mean, I began as a writer in terms of like a full-time job a year after leaving college. I had moved to India because I had this idea that a mentor had helped shape in me, which is the way you become a writer is, you know, not by hanging around the New York Times or the Washington Post trying to get an internship, but go far out into the world and see something that other people are not seeing and, you know, come home to tell people about it. And that was very, very good advice. And, you know, my family's Indian immigrants and I had visited India a little bit as a child, but grew up in the United States, born in the United States, American citizen, didn't have that much of a connection to India. But, you know, I had the kind of psychodrama with India in place of a connection with it because of this kind of immigrant background. So many immigrants have this complicated love-hate relationship with this place that they're from, you know. And I decided I would move there after college. And a year into moving there, working in business, which was a big mistake for me, I got a job at the New York Times, covering India for the Times.
Wow.
And did that for the next 5 years, but you know, stayed at the New York Times in one form or another for the next 11 years. But the story in India was a really interesting story. This was the 2000s, 2005 to 2009 kind of period. It was a period many people will recall of kind of the big narrative in the world was like the booming of India and China, right? And China was growing at 10% a year GDP. India was sometimes growing at 7 or 8, kind of not quite the same speed. You know, obviously I know that the Chinese boom story has been kind of a bigger part of Australia's discussions for lots of reasons involving trade and resources and all kinds of
things. Although it's a massive South Asian population in Australia.
Yeah.
And yeah, for sure. The India story is very connected.
It was a big thing. And I was there at the center of it. And, you know, for those people watching the China story, it was always a story of big, hard things like bridges being built, buildings being built. You go to Shanghai and it would just be like 4,000 buildings that have been built and no one was living in them yet.
Yes.
But they were ready for the next million people to move there. I mean, it was just an extraordinary story of kind of material, hard power growth, right? And the India story, as I was trying to figure it out as a young reporter, it was not the same thing. It was not growing as fast. India is a tough place to build things. The past kind of persists in India in ways that the past was in many ways being erased in China and had been erased in China. And so I was trying to figure out like, what is really happening here? What is the story? What is the meta story that I am covering here? Right? Because I'm doing this article and I'm doing that article and I'm chasing this and I'm chasing, but like, particularly as I, in the latter half of that 5 year period, started writing a book. Like, what is the story that I am telling here? And I came to see that the real story I was telling in India was a story of that took place in the mind and in the heart. And it was a story of a country deeply ancient in its ways and its structures and its ideas of things like life, work, the well-lived existence, the way parents should be with their children and children should be with their parents, who you should marry, all the things that make us human. These things were old and entrenched, and in a blink of history in the era that I happened to be there in, they were unraveling. They were changing. They were changing with a speed that they had probably never changed in thousands of years of history in India. They were changing because of globalization, because of India opening up trade to the world, because of, you know, a lot of the kind of post end of history kind of stuff that happened everywhere. Tom Friedman writing The World is Flat. It was an era in which a lot of change was happening very fast in a lot of places, and particularly in India. But the India story was really a story of this ancient culture colliding with the new world in this very intensely rapid way. And I began to realize my project in that moment as a correspondent for the New York Times as a project of telling the story of that grappling, right? In very, in very precise ways. So I'm being theoretical, but let me be very precise for a second. There is a moment in a family in small town India, let's say in a town called Nagpur where I reported or other places, where no woman will have worked outside the family in a job They will have fetched water. They will have done any number of other things on a farm, but not in a job in, you know, forever. Mm. And a father will raise his daughter on the assumption that they both share that she will not either. And then the dad hears how much ICICI Bank is paying entry-level women in town. And suddenly in that moment, that father, not all the time, but a pretty significant percentage of the time in the India era of India that I was living in, that dad will be like, you know what? I've actually always supported girls' empowerment. I absolutely favor my daughter getting a job in town once he heard about that starting salary. And one family at a time, women would start working in places like banks. They would start taking taxis by themselves to a job because there's no other way to get there in the area they lived in. And one kind of transaction at a time, if you can call them transactions, a decision to take a job, a son insisting that he's going to marry someone he loves, even if it means tearing his family apart rather than going with someone chosen for him. I was in the midst of a story of millions of small personal revolutions. And I was in the middle of a story of millions and millions of people coping with change and trying to figure out, who am I? Am I still Indian if I marry for love instead of kinship duty? Am I still a good family member if I work and don't come home to take care of the kids until 7 p.m.? Am I still Indian if I don't go to the temple twice a day the way my parents and grandparents did? Who am I in this new world? And that really became, I dwell on the story because it was such a formative thing for me. I think a lot of journalists are focused on what happens in the marble corridors of power in Delhi or in Washington or in Paris. A lot of journalists are focused on kind of the hard business stuff that happens. How many buildings went up? How many billions are being spent? I learned in those days, for better or for worse, my method and my focus and my interest, which is to look at individual people trying to figure out the big forces of their time, trying to cope with them, trying to bend them to their will, trying to ride the wave of them, sometimes being, you know, outmaneuvered by them, sometimes being able to outmaneuver them. But that became my big subject, I think, of my life in that context.
And what I am hearing is that it wasn't just them either. It sounds like it was also an exploration for you, you know, like change yourself, change the world. Like this idea that in going all the way back to India or to India, you had, you explored and understood something about your, you know, your background, the people, the places in which you'd come from, but also something in yourself, like being able to see and make choices about who you were. I'm wondering how that experience changed you, yes, as a journalist, but also as a person. Like, how did that make you different that time in India?
Yeah, it's such a good point. I mean, in fact, when I was writing my first book, which is about India and about what I was just describing to you, one of the editors who I was talking to at a publishing house said to me, American readers may or may not be interested in how India is changing. I wish they were very interested in it, but they may or may not be. What they will be interested in is how your India changed, how your idea of India changed. Mm. And then if you can hook them on that, they'll, you know, you can get them to read about how India, the nation, changed. And so I did write my first book about India very much in that vein. And I wrote about this notion of growing up in essentially one of the richest countries in the world, the United States of America, with parents who had come from one of the poorest countries in the world, India, and growing up with the knowledge that, you know, the first thing I ever learned about India, the first fact I ever learned about India, was that my parents had chosen to leave it.
Mm,
that is not the best advertisement for a place, right? And every immigrant child, second generation, whatever you want to call it, has this experience. The first fact you learn about this place is a very negative Yelp review left by your parents because they got out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Good or bad, push or pull, they got out. So that's the founding of the relationship. And in my parents' case, it wasn't just you know, being pushed out by deprivation or anything like that. They were relatively privileged people who came because India was stifling. You know, they were stifled in different ways. My mother more as a kind of woman, not allowed to exist and take space in the world and do what she wanted. My dad as someone in the economy who was living in a in an era of a kind of nationalist, you know, closed economy experiment in India that was very, very kind of frustrating to anybody who wanted to build and create and do things. But I had a relationship to India that started with that knowledge of impossibility. And it wasn't just a narrative or an anecdote. India really was, in those days, a land of impossibility for most people. It was impossible for most people in India to realize their God-given potential. It was impossible for most women to be the full range of people they can be in the world. It was impossible for most people born in historically downtrodden castes to have their gifts reach the world. Mm. And so when I would visit as a child, I loved my family. I loved sitting on my grandparents' bed and sharing stories. I loved the food. I loved this and that. But the visits in my childhood didn't contradict the story of a place better to have left. They built on it. They amplified it. They fleshed it out. And again, it was built on, there were other truths, but it was built on truth. It was built on the idea that this really is a place that, unlike the place I was lucky enough to grow up in, you know, and the United States has plenty of its flaws, its own flaws, which we can get into. But, you know, India was a place that took the magic that every human being has inside them, and in the overwhelming majority of them, squashed it so it couldn't be realized. And you feel that in a place. That's the worst thing you can imagine, the worst failure a society can have. And so when I was there in the 2000s, that was the thing starting to break. That was the thing starting to change. It still hasn't changed for probably even most people, but it's changed for a lot of people. It's changed for hundreds of millions of people in India since the 1990s. And I don't think I will ever in my lifetime live amid an explosion like that. It is hard to even convey how powerful a force that is. Mm. In one of my articles in the New York Times, described it as the gravitational force of condensed hope, because it was like millions and millions of people, starting with so many women, basically the first in their entire lineage of women to be able to study and work in ways that, you know, in the world. Same with lots and lots of lower caste people and so on. People just born in small towns, people from villages, right? Suddenly discovering this idea, let alone the reality. First of all, just the idea that you can seek your own level, that you can make your own fate, that you can chase some dream that wasn't your dad's dream and your grandfather's dream, that you can do a thing that wasn't ordained for you. That idea was so powerful. And it started to be true, not for everybody, maybe not even for most people, but for a very significant chunk of the country. And it was one of the most, one of the things in my career that I got to see, to witness, for which I'm most grateful.
And I tell you what, like, just as an aside, because I want to talk about how you then came to Persuaders, being able to watch what, you know, even if it was for a limited proportion of people, what seems like an really effective story about the embrace of radical change, that is a fairly inspiring story in a moment in time where, you know, when we look at, say, at the climate crisis and we go, oh, goodness, there needs to be a moment of radical embrace of change. You've seen it. Like, you've lived it. You've seen how it can take hold in a community. That has to, it sounds like to me that that's an important anchor for thinking about how one approaches the question of change. If you've seen radical change occur in a place, then I imagine you could, even if it's hard to see how it could happen again, it could happen again. You've seen it.
Yeah, but I would say it's a double-edged point, because you're right. I did live through and see a moment in which a very, in a way, self-confidently, proudly ancient society, and I don't mean antiquated. I just mean like a place that's done certain things, thought about certain things a certain way for a really long time, was able to rewrite many of its stories very quickly. And that's really inspiring. You know, if you've spent time in India or places like it, you will know that, you know, stick with this notion of how women are kind of pigeonholed and how their place is understood and how they themselves are taught to understand their place. It's an entire culture unto itself, that it's a whole world, that thing. Like everything in the culture is working overtime to reinforce that notion and keep women in their place but make them feel like there's no other choice, so on and so forth. And to watch that like just shatter in the lives of so many people, right? It's incredible. It's an incredible, incredible thing. I've seen it happen in my own family. I've seen it happen in small towns. It was happening in a way more dramatically the further you went away from the big city, because in the big city, you know, people had been exposed to certain ideas for some time. The parents, the grandparents also were exposed to certain ideas for some time. It wasn't a sudden revolution. But you go to small towns and villages and you had women going from like never being allowed to leave the house to working a job for an IT company, you know, an hour away and like commuting by themselves every day, you know, just a complete moral revolution. And you realize like that's possible. The reason I say it's double-edged is India is now under, as so many places have been, fallen into like an authoritarian, more nationalist, exclusionary political regime. And part of my diagnosis of why it is and why America also has a less popular but still very dangerous authoritarian movement afoot is that sometimes when these big changes are happening, we fail to kind of help people get their moorings in that period. And particularly when as it was in India in those days, it just feels so optimistic. It is broadly optimistic. I think sometimes there's a tendency to ignore what is actually going on for many people, even amid optimistic change, which is that change is just completely disorienting and discombobulating to people, even good change. It does not matter if the change
is. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Right. And I think this is one of the big mistakes. We think that if a change is good, then like you just do that change. And, you know, so to stick with this notion of empowering women, you know, whether it's in Western societies the last 50, 60 years, in India, in the way I was writing about in the more recent decades, it's absolutely obviously the right thing to do. You and I would agree. However, to empower women in that way is basically to like go to a garment and, you know, start cutting a thread here and a thread there and pulling on them. Like there will be no garment left very soon, right? Like the role of women in any culture, the role of half the people in any culture is basically like what the society is, what the culture is, right? And so that was changed and there wasn't necessarily thought to, okay, but then what happens to this? How do men figure out who they are if they're not sole providers? How do men, you know, figure out a way of feeling good about themselves that doesn't without needing to dominate, all these things, right? We just do the change and we don't think about how people, whether they're the winners from change, the losers from change, neutral, how they need to actually change themselves to adapt, to cope, to feel whole. And I think when I think about the era I was writing about India in the 2000s, but also that it was kind of the era of Davos and the world is flat and all this optimism about globalization versus say 2024, 20 years later, I think the big thing we all missed was that a lot of these changes people were excited about and some of the ones they were not excited about were actually much more psychologically destabilizing to people than a lot of people realized. And 20 years on, I think the major story of our era is not that the world is flat, is not that, you know, trade flows and capital flows can work wonders. It's that a lot of people are not okay around the world.
Yeah.
A lot of people are just not okay. Forget our leaders. Like a lot of regular people are not okay. And we are seeing around the world the politics of a lot of people not being okay.
Yep. I think there's real wisdom in what you're describing. Obviously, lived experience wisdom in seeing it in India, but I think that there's an enormous politics of reaction to change, that if change making is not conscious of the reaction to its action, then we can get ourselves in trouble. And that's not to blame the change making. Like, no one wants to pull back the feminist revolution in India, nor other change, right? But to recognize that there will be a reaction in those that had power, and that that is going to need to be find a new balance in society. And if it doesn't, it might find an aggressive and toxic form of politics. To be understanding that all happens is a way of being able to diagnose what's going on today. Mm-hmm.
And think about, I mean, with this podcast, think about how many different, if you're interested in the topic of change making, think about how many resources there are, how many podcasts on change making, how many books about change making, how many seminars about change making, right? How many equivalent things are there about change coping, you know,
or right? even in the world of change making, talking about it in this more existential practice kind of way? Because I think a lot of change making is discussed. That's what's interesting about your book, is that you don't do this, is discuss this. Here's the six steps you need to take to make change in the world, not here's the environment in which change occurs, and here are the tensions and dilemmas and difficulties that are encountered when you make change. Still make change, but think about those bigger questions.
Yeah. And I think it counsels in me at least a skepticism of our own desire for progress in a way that doesn't factor in, you know, human inertia and human need. So to go back to your thing on climate, I am as passionate a believer in the most maximal response to climate change that you'll find. Like, if on my kind of the way I vote and the way, like, I'm as bought in as you can get. I think my team, if I can call it that, has a huge problem first of all, often not offering a really inspiring end state vision of the kind of sustainable world we want to create. And it's all just like mitigating disaster, which is not very inspiring to people. But second, I think my team has a problem of not realizing that what we are asking of people is inherently stressful and is totally going to raise up a lot of people's defense mechanisms. And that is normal and it's okay. It doesn't make them bad people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yep. We absolutely yep. are trying to raise the question of whether the way you've been eating, the kind of jobs you've been doing, the way you've been powering your home, the way you've been driving, moving physically through the world, it's all wrong suddenly. And yep. by the way, we got this whole here in our jacket sleeve, we got a bunch of different things we'd like to sell you of new ways you should be doing all those things, right? You have to have a very limited understanding of human nature to think that that's not going to be stressful to people. And I think yeah. a lot of folks in the climate movement are much better at articulating what's wrong with the old way, or saying how ExxonMobil is corrupt and dangerous, which is true, than saying, hey, I totally get that what we're asking for seems terrifying, seems expensive, yes. seems unaffordable. Here's why I want to walk with you through that, right? I think if our movements on a bunch of issues showed up more in that spirit, we'd get a lot further than we are now.
And this is a perfect segue to your book, right? Your book is called Persuaders. And I think in some ways what you're describing is a lot of social change is focused on targets, right? We're focused on that company, that politician, right? These external decision makers. But actually, in the art of making change, your book brings to, you know, and we know about it, and you write about it powerfully in the setup to the book too, that actually part of the art of making change is the constituencies and communities who are affected by change, whether it's people who are not necessarily like the strongest opponents, but often those people who are uncertain, you know, about how that change is going to play out, whether they play out and think that it's going to be okay, or whether they end up thinking that what you're proposing is a disaster, is often the deciding factor when it comes to social change, and such an important part of change that sometimes by focusing on targets, focusing on a single decision maker, sometimes change makers cannot that they don't think about it, but maybe not think with the same level of sophistication about those individuals as they do about the decision maker. Tell us about, you know, I guess start us at the start. Like, why did you call it persuaders? Why did you think that was a piece that was missing or needed in this space?
Well, I'll give you the inside scoop, which is that I originally called it persuasion, and my, you know, thinking it was a kind of cute nod to the past, and my editors felt like I would not, in fact, be able to compete with Jane Austen. So
I was going to say, people didn't get the Jane Austen link.
I thought I could give her a run for her money on the Google rankings, or maybe benefit from some people looking up her book instead of mine. But so it was partly that, but it was also, and this was a suggestion that was made to me by my editor, John Siegel, one of the great nonfiction editors in the United States. He said, this is not a book about like a theme or an idea of like, what's the theory of persuasion? This is a book about people, right? Which is always what I end up writing, a book about people doing things, figuring things out, struggling with things. I really think specialize in a way in people grappling with stuff, people who are themselves not sure of certain things. And he said, you know, this is a book about people. And who are these people? They're the persuaders that you're writing. And so it's a book about a relatively small group of people, activists on the kind of progressive side of American politics, organizers, educators, others. They're not all one thing. But it's what connects this kind of motley but interconnected group of people. Some of them know each other, have worked together. Is that they're a group of people who have consistently advocated for persuasion, a persuasive approach in an age in which a lot of the dominant approach has been preaching to the choir, rallying your own faithful, kind of writing off people who are not with you and trying to just get things done by appealing to your own flock. And in a lot of our political movements, persuasion, the word itself in certain political movements and in certain activist circles has become almost a dirty word, right? That you don't, that it kind of implies like a watering down of what you believe in the hope of pulling other people in. Mm. And I was interested in this group of people who, on the one hand, are pretty committed to significant social reform in the United States and around the world. No one can really impeach their credentials for wanting real and big change. They're not sellouts. They're not moderates, the people I wrote about. But on the other hand, the same people, unlike a lot of their own peers in these movements and other spaces, were very interested in having more people join their cause every day than were in it yesterday. And having more people, you know, adhere to their beliefs. And they measured in some ways their success, not, you know, by the yardstick of their righteousness, but, you know, through the kind of census of their ranks. And that was a very, you know, the notion of calling it the persuaders came from just saying, you know what, this is a group of people I'm actually writing about. And they're in a way grappling with some of the same things in common, and they've kind of fought against their own peers in some of these organizations and movements. And let's tell the story of how they did that.
And so, look, there's a million things that we could literally spend all day. This is one of my favorite topics, and I read your book with a fine tooth comb. One of the things that you then go into, you say, writing off those who don't agree with you, this tension around how do we deal with difference in the book. And you speak with early on in the book, Loretta Ross and Alicia Garza, about questions of identity and difference and challenges of solidarity and how do we create and cast solidarity. I wonder if you could explore a little for us, okay? So we're broadly looking at persuaders. We're broadly looking at like how do we increase the number of people supporting our movement, but actually our movement is made up of people who are really different, and some of those differences are big that sit between us, especially around race. How did you learn and explore from them about handling these questions of difference and identity and how they play out?
I think one very fundamental question facing a lot of movements right now is whether people need to be perfect and flawless in their understanding of issues before they come into your movement as a precondition for walking in, whether your movement kind of has a moral bouncer on the outside, checking people's credentials and appropriate use of and knowledge of, you know, feminist terms and kind of racial ideas and gender pronouns and everything's in order. You got to prove everything's in order before you walk into the movement, or whether you build movements that are self-confident enough and high capacity enough in their teaching ability that they can take all kinds of people wherever those people are starting out and deal with them as they are. In other words, movements that are self-confident enough and high capacity enough that they have plenty of people in them who are people of color, who are very cognizant in a kind of language of the kind of self-assertion and the assertion of dignity of people of color that has grown and has spread in recent decades, rightfully, but also movements where, you know, a rural white person from Michigan or a rural white person from Australia can walk into that movement and say something like, "What do you mean white supremacy? Everybody's poor in my town. I don't know what white supremacy is." And that movement can handle that in a way that is neither dismissive of a newcomer who is still figuring things out, nor injurious to a person of color for whom that rightfully may be triggering. And I think the ability, first of all, you have to start with the notion that, like, someone saying that in a meeting, which is like the exact kind of stuff that happens every day in these situations, you have to acknowledge that that white person is not being a bad person by saying, "I don't really understand this white supremacy thing. Everybody where I grew up is poor." That is a totally normal thing to say if you've never heard these terms, if you were not educated in this stuff, and if that's your life experience. At the same time, you have to acknowledge that that is a really potentially very hurtful thing for a person of color to hear sitting in that space who's experienced their whole life on the wrong end of white supremacy and now has to sit here and hear someone in what they presume to be a safe and comfortable space telling them that the thing that has structured their existence is not real. I think we all need to hold a little more complexity in this era. To me, both of those things are like the most valid things. Those are both completely authentic experiences of the world that two very decent people can have. So then the question is, do you have a movement capacious enough and self-confident enough and high capacity enough that it can handle that moment inside? Or is your movement effectively telling people, you work that shit out on the outside before you come in? You have to be all figured out before you come in. And I think if we're being honest, particularly in a moment of rising fascism in the United States and elsewhere, progressive movements around the world, but I focus on those in the United States, have often not been very good at this, have often had too high a barrier to entry, a barrier to entry of knowledge, of awareness, of familiarity with, frankly, concepts that are like largely academic in nature, and have not been self-confident in their ability to educate people inside instead of telling them there's prerequisites to take the course. And I think that's a big problem. I think there's a growing recognition of it. In many ways, the Persuaders is, among other things, an intervention with a loving intervention with these movements for progress saying, hey, the way you get the future you seek, particularly when you're up against the most ruthless authoritarian nationalist movements in decades, the way you get the future you want is by having a spirit of nonviolent conquest. You need to be grabbing territory, which is to say the hearts of people every day. You need to be converting people like you're a religion. You need to be pulling in people, not just who agree with you. Your movement needs to be full of people who don't agree with you, but just want to be in your movement for some reason. That's when you know you are winning. And I think it's a lesson a lot of our movements need.
And the movement needs to be big enough for people who are going to disagree with each other. Like if we believe in a democracy, right, which is privileged on the idea that you're allowed to disagree with each other, our movements should prefigure that in a way. Like there should be spaces that allow for diversity, but also that allow for people to change. Like I actually just love that you're setting the bar higher for what a movement of change needs to be. Right, you're saying that a movement of change, and as the leaders in the book do, Loretta Ross in particular, I think makes such a beautiful contribution on this work, which is, you know, talking about how we just need to be a space where people are able to be different and they can find themselves in the movement. And that doesn't mean that the end result of this process is that everyone in the movement is the same, that the movement is just allowed to be different and constantly diverse, and that's what's good about it. That's why it works. That's what solidarity in this form means.
Yeah, one of the things Loretta says that's so powerful, Loretta Ross is such a wise voice in the book, and one of the things she says is that a lot of us are very bad at threat assessment these days, right? And that if you are not able to distinguish someone who is struggling to remember pronouns, the correct pronouns, with someone who wants to murder people, all people with the wrong pronouns in their view, if you can't tell a kind of baffled 55-year-old who's struggling to grasp a new concept from someone with exterminationist fantasies, you have a real problem and you have a real political problem on your hands. And I think a lot of us are guilty of doing this in one form or another, making bad threat assessment. And I would say it zooms out to a broader point that I think is, you know, threaded throughout The Persuaders, which is that, you know, I think a lot of us conflate the powerful perpetrators of some of the big bad forces of our age with the unfortunate victims of those con artists who vote for bad things and vote against our own dignity and stuff, but are not the same. And, you know, one of your country's truly worst exports in history.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry. Sorry.
You know, but like the example here is a lot of us, and I've been guilty of this, would conflate a Rupert Murdoch with a 55-year-old out of work factory worker in Michigan spouting off about migrants at the border. Now, both of them are problematic and they might have the same politics, but one of them is purely a perpetrator using an outsized amount of power. And the other is certainly perpetrating through the way he votes, and he's making my life more dangerous and he's endangering my country. And I have a problem with all of that. But he's also a victim of Rupert Murdoch, right? Mm. If my view of Rupert Murdoch as problematic is correct, it's correct precisely because Rupert Murdoch has victims like that man. And I think one of the things progressive movements have struggled with is the notion of being able to both hold regular people like that accountable and view them as being in some ways just as much victims of the powerful forces we deplore.
And in the book, you talk about this sort of dynamic of calling out and calling in, and actually lots of your change makers, or your characters, I'm not sure exactly how to call them, but, you know, AOC and Loretta Ross and Alisa Gaisa also talk about this dynamic of calling out and calling in, and actually that there can be a relationship between the two, like often that in sometimes in identity movies, people will call out some bad behavior in someone else, but often based on a lack of respect for someone's identity. But what Loretta Ross in particular emphasizes is the need for actually calling in as much more effective as a strategy. Having a quiet conversation rather than shaming someone in public is actually often a more powerful strategy. But then there also is a time to call out, but who you're calling out and who you're calling in, call out those with power, call in those who are potentially victims, like being able to understand with whom these different conversational or communications techniques work with is so important and not necessarily always understood.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are kind of lulled into the trap of I think as Loretta talks about in the book, going after the person you can go after because they're the ones proximate to you, right? Mm. So you rage against a kind of well-meaning colleague at work who says something hurtful, but you kind of are silent on the fact that the private equity owner of your corporation that you work for, you know, has been found responsible for shortening many people's lives in nursing homes after they bought up a bunch of nursing homes and loaded them with debt and kind of strip mined them. And like lots and lots of people are dying because of your parent company. But somehow that just feels like too big or too abstract.
Well, you don't know. You don't know how to go after that. Like, I think that's part of the challenge. Like, who knows how to go after
that? But like Martha in accounting.
Go after Martha. Yeah, I can totally take her out.
And so, and I think that's a, you know, that's a problem. And a lot of the most powerful actors in the world who I've written about in another book, part of how they maintain their power is through their deliberate obscurity to us and by turning us on each other and making us think that our intolerant uncle is the enemy. When, you know, in some ways he might be, but in other ways he's in many ways the real victim of the great con of these billionaire manipulators.
I know. And in another podcast on another day, we will talk about some of your other books because Winners Take All is a masterpiece on taking down philanthropy. But I'm conscious today is the day about persuaders. Look, just pulling it back. So we've talked about this question of difference. You're talking about the idea of persuaders being how to build a as big a group as possible, you know, to contest. If we're contesting some of the most difficult challenges of time, then we're going to need to have more people rather than less. What are some of the other attributes of change makers, persuaders that you, that stood with you, that you thought were particularly important? I mean, I don't want you to pick favorites, but, you know, if you would mind, you know, identify a couple of the sort of key attributes that you thought were important.
You know, I think one of the things that often when I'm working on a book like this, I find the different characters I'm interested in writing about, you know, it's somewhat random. I mean, who is willing to be written about, who catches your eye because of what they're doing. And it's not particularly strategic process. You kind of want to make sure, okay, do I have someone in this area? Do I have someone in this area? Is it the right mix of people? But it's not like a top-down, you know, plan. You kind of end up with a motley group. And then one of the things that's happened with all my books is that after you assemble that group and you start, you know, in this case, it's a book where these people are kind of, I write about them separately. So one chapter about AOC, one chapter about Loretta Ross, so on and so forth. You kind of are focused on telling each of their individual stories. And then sometimes these larger commonalities emerge between and among these people's stories that you're reporting. And that becomes very interesting because you didn't choose them because they had these things in common. You just chose them because they were people grappling in common with a kind of rough question. And I would say some of those things very much emerge in the persuaders. And that's always very illuminating to me. So one of the things was a lot of the really effective persuaders I wrote about in the book, they shared a common biographical fact of being straddlers of worlds in their backgrounds and often their childhoods. And what I mean by that is people who didn't have one baked reality, one homogeneous baked reality, right? So that's, you know, AOC grew up partly in the Bronx, which is, I think, literally the poorest county in the United States, and also part of the time in Westchester County, which is the county in the first suburban county outside New York City, but is literally one of the richest counties in the United States and one of the richest places in the world. She was back and forth, often weekend in one place, week in the other. Right? I do not think it is a coincidence that actually, even more than someone who grew up purely in Westchester County or purely in the Bronx, that it is AOC who had both places, who knew what it was like to be a lucky person in the Bronx, who was comparatively lucky relative to her cousins in the Bronx, and then who knew what it was like to be the one brown kid in class in Westchester County. I don't think it's a coincidence that that person turned out to be the single most effective exponent of ideas of solidarity and justice and, frankly, of rage from below in a way that was legible to all kinds of people at the bottom and the top.
Yeah.
Right? Loretta Ross talks about being a, you know, a Black civil rights activist, Black, you know, in Black nationalist discussion circles in the 70s, et cetera, but also growing up as an army brat on in a bunch of like mostly white towns or mixed race towns, never having really a solid black community, but being from a black family, her father kind of being a right wing military guy who was really interested in guns, but was also a beneficiary of the civil rights, you know, movement. You know, her parents being religious, and at the same time, her becoming someone who was, you know, very interested in issues in which religious people were often the main opponent. I think it has made someone like her much more thoughtful about something like, which I discussed with her, how do you frame government-provided healthcare as a virtue to someone like her dad, who's a military guy who thinks we're best left alone to our own freedom? Well, she waited and she waited. And then one day when her dad was, I think, retired, his military provided healthcare had a problem, couldn't access it. The bureaucracy wasn't working and it was a problem for him. And she took the moment to say, hey, this is why it's so important for everybody to not have to worry the way you're worrying right now. This is why, right? And so if you don't have these different experiences of the world, it's maybe harder to be a persuader, which is to say, I think there is a special place, not to say that other people can't get in the game. We need everybody in the game. But I think people who have straddled worlds, who come from, you know, mixed race backgrounds, who've lived in different types of places, who have known wealth and known poverty, for all, you know, who are adopted and have lived in, you know, different realities that way. There's all kinds of people walking among us, very large numbers of people who are straddlers of different realities and who may be unusual in their own circles because of that. And I think those people have special powers of persuasion. I think, for example, President Barack Obama, I mean, the simple shorthand in the Wikipedia page, the history book, is first black president. I don't think it's an accident that he had a white mother and came not just from white people on one side, but like really, really salt of the earth, like middle of the country, white people. Right. Mm. And I think, you know, and a black father is not a conventional American black father, but was an immigrant from Kenya with its own history. Right. So in one person, you had a kind of black experience. You had a white, like small town conservative religious experience. You had an immigrant experience. The fact that he was able to speak to so many different types of people, right? And relate to their experience and have their experiences relate to him. I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think that the fact that he was able to get there where even other black, very dynamic black leaders like Jesse Jackson were not, I don't think it's entirely a coincidence. He was always many, many, many things, right? And he always straddled many, many realities. Mm. And I think there's a lot of power in our era for people who are able to do that.
Yeah. Boundary crossers, bridge builders. I mean, your description of your own life speaks to that as well. This idea that you can see and understand different places, even if your own trajectory is distinct, being able to have greater sympathy for people who are different to you because you've existed in different places. I think that that's a really powerful observation, because in some ways what we're talking, your book is not the book that says, this is how you fight to battle that, you know, that big company or that big politician. Your book is about saying, how do we build networks of people across, of ordinary people? How do we go about doing that? And for people to sort of recognize that those who can straddle between different places, who can exist within different communities, or at least who can understand different existences, become particularly powerful. And that actually those people are everywhere. That's not like, you speak to some pretty special skilled people. Like, I don't think everyone thinks of themselves, oh yeah, I could just be like AOC. But what you're describing, the qualities you're describing in her are qualities that actually maybe can widespread, and that many people have. Not everyone necessarily, but that many people have. So look, we're getting towards the end of the podcast and I appreciate your time. I want one more question though, just a final question. And I'm just to ask you, okay, you wrote this book, you say, you know, like even though clearly you've encountered lots of change and you've experienced, you've been buffeted by and dealt with change, you have not been a change maker. You've written several books that have spoken into this space though. In particular with persuaders, how did persuaders change you?
I think it changed me a lot. I think it changed me more than any of my other books. And my wife always tells me this, and it kind of annoys me because it makes me think that
she thought the other ones count.
She was not particularly, I was not particularly persuasive before. But I think it really changed me because, you know, I think the era in which it landed was the era, you know, that I, as much as anybody else, was living in an era of kind of social media and of this kind of frenzied discourse that was often very long on certitude and short on curiosity. And I think of myself as a curious person. I ask people questions for a living, except when I'm being asked questions like on this podcast. And yet I feel I very much was swept up in the culture of the social media era and the culture of certitude and the culture of like the easy right answer and the culture of the kind of facile retort and simplification and those kinds of things. And I was, you know, swept into those things the way so many of us are because we're trying to survive in the era we live in and we're trying to communicate in the era we live in. But when I started talking to some of these persuaders that I write about in the book, I realized that I was fighting for a certain kind of world or certain kinds of change in ways that actually were perhaps tending towards driving people away and kind of smallness and just, you know, making my own small side feel good, but not expand. And I was sort of shamed by the realization. And a lot of what the people who I write about in The Persuaders taught me is to be relentlessly focused on bringing people in. And at the heart of that, and I actually, these are the last two words of the book in the acknowledgments. I've dedicated the book to a group of my friends who got me through COVID. And I wrote of them what I, you know, I said that they taught me what many people in this book already, you know, seem to know, which is that openness opens. And I think I learned a lot from spending time with the characters in this book that, that to be able to change others, you have to kind of have a certain openness yourself. You have to be willing to accommodate stories of other people that are more complicated than the ones you may have received about them. You have to be able to hold in your mind the notion that there's more going on in people. There's more inner conflict going on in people than it may meet the eye. And so I would say if I got anything from the people I wrote about, I don't think I ended up as good at it as them, but I learned that spirit that is captured in those closing words of the acknowledgments. Openness opens.
I love it. I love it. And I do think that you've honored that practice of, you know, if you want to change the world, first you change yourself. There's clearly a dynamic going on in your writing that is allowing you to reach out, but also reach in. That's really, that I think is what makes it so powerful. So people, everyone will go and buy their copy of Persuaders because it is a spectacular book. I couldn't recommend it more highly. And I hope you write another one about some other interesting twist. Maybe what's going on in America might give you some fuel. I wish you the best with that. We, as I say, we're all watching what's going on. And I'm sure that your book will help people as we all grapple with this difficult time that we're in.
Yeah. And if things go really bad here, maybe I'll come live over there.
Well, look, we'll always have you. We love people. our openness opens, right? You know, you're welcome. Maybe not our government, though. They're pretty bad on that sort of stuff. But us are the people. We're very open.
Thank you so much for your time and your wonderful questions.
My pleasure. It's a delight. Thank you so much. Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. This is Series 8, so there's plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. Ananda's written 4 books, India Calling, True American, Winners Take All, and Persuaders. They are all fantastic. Winners Take All is a potent critique of philanthropic culture, and Persuaders, well, you've just heard all about it today. Links to how to get your hands on these spectacularly good books are in the show notes. Changemakers Audio producer is Jules Walkerer. We are broadcast on Acast and are part of the Iconoclast Network. Changemakers UK episodes are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the UCL, that is University College London, Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. Like us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads at Changemakers Podcast. We're on Twitter, X, Changemakers99. I'm sometimes there too at Amanda Tatts. And check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.